So we're on Daf Chaf Amid Beis. Let's see where we'll begin. Yeah, I think we can start with the Mishnah. Trouble is we didn't finish the Gemara about Kfiya Sanmita. What's a Dargash? Maybe we'll just go back to that. So the Mishnah, we're on Chaf Amid Aleph now. And the Mishnah on Chaf Amid Aleph had established the halacha of Nicham Avelim when the Melech is sitting Shiva for one of his krovim. And it says that the people who come, they bring a Suda Savra, they sit on the ground, and the Melech has to be elevated above the ground. So he's sitting on something called a Dargash. So we were trying to figure out what exactly is a Dargash. We had Ula, and the Gemara rejects Ula. Now, why does the Gemara reject Ula? Well, first of all, what does Ula say? Ula says that, again, this is a whole sociology, that back in the day, they used to designate one bed that was perfectly arranged, but it was not used. So why did they have a bed that wasn't used? And Ula says that they did it for the purpose of mazel, that it was good luck because it would sort of wave those forces of anius, you know, that would prosecuting forces of evil that would bring poverty into the hall. So by designating this bed for mazel, for good luck, and they didn't use it at all, that would ward away these forces. That Rashi Dibar Maskel Dargosh seems to indicate that we're talking about some sort of a nichush. You know, this was like superstition. However, Tosa Rosh says that this is not called nichush, which is also because of Derech HaMori, but rather there was some sort of meaning to the cleanliness of this bed. And I'm not exactly sure. I'll just read to you the words of the Tosa Rosh as they're quoted here in the Mesifta. Ein ze nichush ha'osu mishum darki amori. This does not constitute nichush, and which again is darki amori. That was a kind of superstitious practice that was common amongst the nations that occupied the land of Israel. Ella, but rather kshabayis noki, when they cleaned up the house, v'yeshbo mita mutzas, when there was a bed that was prepared for sleeping, so ein sar ha'nius shochein bo, el sar ha'shirus ha'rogil lishkon b'makom noki v'tzach. So again, I don't know why that's not nichush. You know, he's got the sar ha'shirus and the sar ha'nius, and if the place is kept spiffy and it's all clean, that would keep away the sar ha'nius. I don't know why that's not called nichush. But if you look at Rashi says mazel, etc., mishum nichush. You see those two words in Rashi, mishum nichush. And the Tosa Rosh wants to say that this is not nichush. I don't know. You'd have to really learn the whole sugi of nichush and try to analyze this. But in any event, this is Ula's interpretation of a dargosh. Now, what we have to know about dargosh, according to Ula, is that this bed looks like any other bed. It was not manufactured in a different way than any other classic bed. Now, why would it be that, according to Ula, the Melech, when he's sitting Shiva, he's going to be placed on this dargosh? I mean, we never put anybody on the dargosh. It's designated for mazel. So the Gemara's first objection to Ula, which we studied last week, was why would we put the melech onto this bed that's used for beauty purposes or mazel purposes, and all of a sudden, you know, for the first time, we're gonna, you know, because the melech is an avel, we're gonna put him down on this bed. I mean, why should we do such a thing? So Rava, I'm just reviewing what we did last week, says that that's not a problem. Everything that we're doing for the avel is different. For example, an avel would normally eat his own food, drink from his own drink, and here on this day of avelus, we're bringing him this sudas avra, and we're feeding him from our food. So here also we make a shinui, we do something different, and we put the melech who's sitting in avelus here, and we sit him down on the dargosh. But the Gemara says, Rava says that we do have a problem with this interpretation of Ula, because we have a principle called dargosh eino tzarech lichfoso el zokfo al dofno, which means the following, that with regard to every other bed in the house, and again, we're not familiar with this today, but back in the day they did what's called kfiya sambito, and they turned the bed upside down, and they slept on the bottom side of the bed instead of the top side of the bed. But the only exception to that is the dargosh. The dargosh doesn't need kfiya sambito. So what do you do with the dargosh during avelus? Zokfo, you stand it up on its top side, meaning, let's say the bed looks like this, so he tips it over this way and it goes vertically up and down. Now, if you're going to tell me the way Ula tells me that dargosh is a bed and it looks like every other bed, why shouldn't we turn it upside down? Did we have a braisa that says that not only does the ovel sleep on a mita kfuya, meaning on a mita that's upside down, but not only that, there's halacha that the entire bayis, insofar as it has the status of a base ovel, every single bed in the house has to be turned upside down. Now, if this bed called the dargosh, according to Ula, looks identical with any other bed, then why not require kfiya samita? So the Gemara says that question is also not an objection. That's not valid. Why? Because it could be that the status of a dargosh, insofar as Ula's interpretation of dargosh, is the same as what's called a mita shel kelim, which means the following, that sometimes if they didn't have enough storage space for vessels in the house, what they did was they designate one of the beds in the house, and they would put all their boxes and all the kelim on top of that bed, and the Braisa says that mito which was designated for kelim doesn't need kfiya samito. Why? Because it's not designated for sleeping. So the halacha of avelus with regard to kfiya samito is limited to a bed that you sleep on. Now let's get back to Rava's Ula's interpretation of dargosh. Dargosh is a bed that was designated for mazel purposes, so it wasn't used for sleeping. And if it wasn't used for sleeping, it has the identical status of a mita hamyuchedes lekelim, which is not used for sleeping, and therefore doesn't require kfiya samita. So what we're up to now, this is where we stopped last week, is ela ikasha ha kasha. So let's see if we could all find the place so that we begin. We begin our Gemara for today. So if you're looking on Daf Chaf Amud Aleph, you're counting up from the bottom of the Avud, I'd say about 8-9 lines. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Eight lines up from the bottom of the page. Ela I Kasha, if there is a Kasha, then Ha Kasha. Now what the Gemara is going to do now is quote a machlokes in a braisa, recorded in a braisa, between Rav Shimon Gamliel and Chachamim. And they're going to debate the case of dargosh. And whether or not, in the case of an ovel, the dargosh needs some sort of a, if not a kfiya samita per se, it needs some sort of replacement for kfiya samita, some sort of a fallback kfiya samita. Now keep in mind, you know, we don't understand what's going on in this brisa because we simply, all we have in front of us is Ula's interpretation of Dargosh. That Dargosh is a bed that looks like any other bed. It's manufactured identically as any other bed. It's just designated for mazel purposes, correct? However, we're going to have to reinterpret Dargosh in the light of this machlokas between the Chachamim and Rav Shimon Gamliel. Now again, exactly what this machlokas is about is itself a machlokas between the Rishonim. According to the Ramban, we'll start with the Ramban Shita, the Chachamim of Rav Shimon Gamliel hold that all you need in the case of Dargosh is to stand it up vertically, as we said before. You don't have to turn it upside down. Whereas Rav Shimon Gamliel is more machmir, and he requires a whole different ritual, so to speak, a whole different procedure with regard to the Dargosh. What is the procedure that he requires? So let's look at the Braisa. Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer, it's not enough to stand it up. I'm learning this Gemara like the Ramban would learn. It's not enough to stand it up vertically, but rather, Dargosh Matir Karbitin Vu Nofel Me'elo. Now, Karbitim are loops, are rings, and the bed, the way it's manufactured here, and you're going to see that it's not your classic bed, is a dargosh. The part of the bed where the person sleeps has to be attached, like in our terms, we would call it a mattress. But I'm not sure that they had mattresses. So let's say they had, you know, sort of ropes that were stretched out on two sides, and it went both length and width, and that whole section would have to be attached to the frame, the wooden frame, which had legs and it had an entire frame. And how would they attach this bed where the person would sleep on to the frame, to the bed frame? They would tie it together with karbitin. Karbitin is the Aramaic equivalent of lulaot. Lulaot in modern Hebrew is rings. So there were rings that would attach it down. You may have seen something similar in the case of schach. Some people, you know, they have rings that attach the schach to the top of the defanos, because otherwise the wind will blow away the schach. Again, there are all sorts of issues about that in halacha and what those loops have to be made of in order for the schach to remain a dover shade of a kabel tuma. But in any event, I was just giving you a mashal of loops, that sometimes a certain substance to be attached to a frame, it needs loops that go around. So those loops are called karbitin. And Rav Shimon Gamliel says it's not enough to take this dargosh, which is again a bed that's attached to the frame with rings, and stand it up vertically. The oval has to go beyond that. But rather what he has to do is he has to unfasten these rings. Now what happens is when he removes the rings, no fail me elof, the bed part that the person sleeps on will fall onto the ground. And that itself, according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, is the kfiya samita that's required by an ovel. So here's where the Gemara rejects Ula's interpretation of dargosh. Isal kedaitach, if you're going to tell me that the dargosh is the arsa degada, that mita that was used for mazel purposes, is karbita miyisle. This mito looks like any other mito in the house. It's not manufactured in any unusual way. Obviously, the dargosh, according to this braisa, is different than your classic bed. Your classic bed doesn't require these karbitin, but rather the warp and woof, in other words, the ropes that form the bed are attached, are directly tied down to the frame of the bed. There's no karbitin. Now again, at this point, we don't even have to enter into the machlokas here between the Chachamim and Rav Shimon Gamliel. You know, the Chachamim say you don't have to remove all the all these lulos, all these rings, all you have to do is leave the rings and everything attached as is. You just have to stand it up vertically. That's enough for Kfir Samit. Rav Shimon Gamliel requires going a step further. He wants to see that the Avil is going to be sleeping on this bed in a very unusual way. It's going to basically fall onto the ground. But either way, we see that the word dargosh in this machlokas in the Braisa is not referring to your classic manufactured bed where there are no karbitin. So therefore, at this point, the Gemara rejects Ula, and we have to reinterpret the word dargosh. Ella, the Gemara says, ki asa Ravin. Ravin came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. Amar, he declared, Amali Ahu Mirabanan. One of the rabbis, Rabbi Tachlifa Shmei, his name is Rabbi Tachlifa, and he told me back in the land of Israel, this bed was a totally different bed. This bed was made of skins, of hides. I guess you'd call it like leather. You know what this reminds me of? I don't know if this helps anybody. Have you ever seen the children, they play on trampolines? You know what I'm talking about? Here in Israel, it's wild. You know, this doesn't originate in Israel, but in Israel now it's taking on like fire. You know, every other family now is buying for their children these gigantic trampolines, and the kids love it. It's a little bit dangerous because they fight and they roll on each other. But anyway, they jump up and down on this trampoline for hours and hours. So that's a good way of keeping the kids. So what is this trampoline? It's got a piece of hide that's stretched, and it has to be attached to the frame. And the frame, as long as it's attached, will cause the hide to be absolutely matuach, we call it in Hebrew, meaning it's stretched out so that it's a flat, bouncy substance, if you know what I mean.
For cots, we have fold-up cots in America. For camping or whatever, or for storage, when people come, it opens up. It's a little metal frame today with a piece of material that's attached, which is used for sleeping.
This material, I don't know, in our contemporary life, it's probably more synthetic of some sort. Yeah, but right. Back in the day, they used it from actual natural hides. The reason why I emphasize this is because you're going to see that there's a whole issue here between the Chachamim and Rav Shimon Gamliel about requiring that these hides hit the ground, right? Because if these hides are attached to the bedposts with lulos, with these karbitin, then according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, he's going very far. When he requires you to loosen these lulos, what's going to happen is that the R is going to hit the ground. And that's could be very financially damaging. You know, these hides are worth money. In fact, how did Rav Tachlifa know about this very unique kind of a bed? Havishchiach b'shuka d'gildoy, because he used to hang around the marketplace. You know, back in the day, and this was true. This is true very much in Poland, and it's true even today, you know, in our time, in many areas. You know, you have, they tell you to go to this street because that's where you find all the glass that they sell, and here they sell this, and here they sell. So the tanners who are in charge of taking natural hide from the animal and tanning it, they were called the Gildoy, and they had their own shuk. These Gildoy, these tanners, had their own marketplace, and Rav Tachlifa would inhabit this marketplace, and he would find out a lot about the business of tanning. Maybe he had to go that way on his way to yeshiva, or maybe he was training to become a tanner himself. It's not clear, but anyway, he was matzui b'shuk haratzanim, ratzanim on the tanners. The Amali. Now, Rav Tachlifa tells Ravin the following: my dargosh, I'll tell you what a dargosh is. It's arsa de tzala. Now the word arsa means a bed, and tzala is this hide that is stretched and it's attached to the bed frame with lulos, with these karbitin that we mentioned before, these rings. And now what happens? If you remove these rings, then this R with an ayin, right? R with an ayin falls down to the ground. And according to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, that's going to be the fulfill. That's going to be the required kfiyas habita in the case of arsa ditzala, which is identical with the dargosh. And basically, as long as the lulos are there and they stretch the R is lifted from the ground, and that's where they sleep on top of this R. Now, if, for example, you would turn this arsa ditzala upside down, which is your classic requirement of kfiya samita, then what's going to happen is the top part of the R that faces the, you know, the sunlight that faces the air, which is the part in which a person sleeps, he puts his body down, that's going to now be turned upside down. That's going to go onto the wet ground. And as a result, that's going to cause a loss. So Rav Shimon Gamliel is not going to go as far as to require kfiyas hamita in this case, because although there's a kiyum of avelus, he doesn't have to lose a very expensive item, a commodity. But what he's going to require is that you loosen it up. So when you loosen up and now it falls to the ground, although you haven't turned it upside down, the under part of the R, which is not the part that his body is attached, is touching, is going to get wet from the wet ground. And again, that will not apparently destroy the object, meaning make it valueless. It's not something that you would normally do, obviously, because you don't want to get it wet, but the moisture will not seep through to the top part of the R. That's how tough the R is. It's impervious in that sense. So what you're left with is the wetness on the underside of this bed, the underside of the R. And maybe you could dry it in the sun, I don't know. But anyway, there's some way of doing it. Now, according to the Chachamim of Shimon Gamliel, we're not going to go so far as to require this form of kfiyas hamita, because we don't want to even force the oval to damage the underside of the R. And therefore, all you need to do, according to the Chachamim, is simply to stand up this bed on its side. So that's again the Ramban's understanding of this Gemara. Tanakama, Mekil, She'efshal, Zokfo, all you have to do is set it up vertically, Vidayo, and that's enough. The Kolshkein, how much more so, that if you would be Mata the Karbitim, then that would certainly be a Kiyum of Avelus, but we don't require that, the Halacha doesn't force him to go that far. Rav Shimon Gamliel, Machmir, Vitzarech Dafka Lahatir HaKarbitim, it's not enough to stand up the bed vertically, but you also have to turn it upside down, so that the oval will sleep on a bed on the ground, and that's a new form of kfiyas hamita. That's the Ramban. The Ritva turns it the other way around. He says the Tanakhama was machmir, and he required zkifa. Rav Shimon Gamliel says, no, you don't have to do zkifa. All you have to do is be mati the karbitin, and that's enough. And how much more so, if you did zkifa, that would certainly be enough. So again, the machlokus between the Ramban and the Ritva is whether or not Zekifa is a kula or a chumra. And the flip side of that is whether or not Hataras HaKarbitin is a kula or a chumra. So if you're going to tell me, according to the Ramban, that Zekifa is a kula, it means Hataras HaKarbitin, where there's some element of damage, that's a chumra of Rav Shimon Gamliel. The Ritva sees it the other way around, that Zekifa is a chumra. Because basically, once you do zkifa on this bed, you can no longer use it as a bed. But b'di'evet, we're going to allow you to sleep on the bed without doing kfiyas hamita if you just remove the karbitim and the R of the bed part of the mishkav will fall onto the ground. Therefore, Amar Rab Yirmiyah, Amar Rab Yochanan, Dargosh, Seirugo Mitocho. Mita, Seiruga Malgava. Okay. Now, this statement of Rabbi Yochanan about the Dargosh is a comparison, or shall we say a contrast, between the Dargosh and your classic Mita. And again, we get back into furniture manufacturing. And he says the following. There are two ways in which we can attach the bed bed to its frame. One is called mitocho, and one is called me'algava. Oh, good. So let me try to figure it out myself, and then hopefully the pictures will support me. Okay, I hope. So what I understand is the following. Here's the difference between a dargosh and a mita in terms of serugo. Serugo means how do we attach the bed to its frame? That's called serugo or kshiraso. Serugo is like kshiraso, tying it down. So one way is it's mitocho, which means the following. We bore holes in the side of the frame. And what we do is we have straps that are attached to the R, right? Because dargosh is made of R. And with these straps, we insert the straps into the holes in such a way that it tightly fits into the holes. And that's what keeps the dargosh, the R, uplifted, if you follow what I mean. In the case of a mita, on the other hand, seruga me'algaba. In other words, those ropes that attach the bed to its wooden frame are on top. On top means that they're not inserted into holes on the sides, but rather they're on top. Okay, so let's see if we can understand the difference between the two. Mesve. Now, in order to understand the Gemara's Kash of Mesve, we have to know one thing about Kliates. Wooden Kalim have a halacha in Masechta Kalim. By the way, if anyone has about a half a year free, learn Masechta Kalim. It is, I think it's probably the longest Masechta Shas. And not only that, if you know, here's where you need Rabbi Steinsaltz. You probably can't learn Masechta Kalim without Rabbi Steinsaltz, because it's all about Kalim that existed back at the time of the Mishnah. And it's very, very complicated. And every keli, you'll have five different shittas about what the keli look like. So if you want to get, you know, if you're in the mood to get headaches, then learn Masechta Kalim. It's a great Masechta for those who want to get headaches. Anyway, so it says in Masechta Kalim that the special halacha of a kliates is that you need what's called Gmar Malacha. Gmar Malacha, which is very similar in Hilchos Shabbos to one of the 39 malachas called Makah V'Patish, Gmar Malacha is when they beautify something with one final manufacturing touch. In other words, the carpenter does one last thing, and that last thing, in a sense, beautifies it. And a kliates is only makabel tumah, only once that very last makabel patish, that very last Gmar Malacha, was implemented. Now, a mita, a bed, is considered a kliates because the frame of the bed, at least, is made of wood. Now, what we want to do is we want to figure out what is the gemar molacha of a mito when they create this frame, this bed frame. They have to do this very last action. That last action, which will complete the shame kli, as far as Kabbalah's Tumah and Kliates is concerned, is called shifshuf in modern Hebrew. Shifshuf means to scrape it or smooth it down. Right? Wood in its natural state is not necessarily smooth, so you have to smoothen it down. And what they did was, they took a fish, and they skinned the fish, and the skin of the fish was used in this process of sanding or smoothing a kliates. Now, the Gemara says the following. These Aruchos Hamita, which let me just read to you his translation of Aruchos Hamita. He says that these are the karshe ha'orech shalamizgeret. So the bed frame is made up of krushim. Krushim are are a long piece of wood. What do they call it in
slats.
English? Slats? No. What's another word for crush? Like in the Mishkan? No. Not slats.
Planks,
maybe planks. So these planks of wood would stretch across the length of the bed, and that's called Aruchos Hamita. And you need shifshuf. Shifshuf means that you have to smoothen out these planks of wood that make up the mizgeret. You sand them down. They used to use, again, the skin of a fish for that purpose. Okay, fine. Now, according to Rabbi Yochanan, the bed is made with seruga malgaba, which means that basically these ritzuos, right? What do we call them? These straps are on top. They're on top, and they're connected somehow, let's say, tied with knots or bows or whatever it is to the mizgeret. That ties down the bed part to the frame. So the Gemara asks the following question: Kliyets meimasai mekabel tuma mito varisa mishe yeshufem. So you need shifshuf, and they used to do it with an R dot. Fine. So the Gemara asks the following question: E according to you, Rabbi Yochanan, mito misoreges me'al gaba. So it means the following: the legs of the bed frame, right, the planks of the bed frame, never actually come in contact with his body. In other words, it becomes absolutely irrelevant for the function of the bed whether you do this shifshuf or not, because what you're talking about is that there's no part of the bed that's really exposed to the aruchos hamito. I'll read to you his Hebrew. He says, "Lefi Rav Yochanan, nimtza sharuchos hamita mechusos bechavolim hakruchim aleihem." That the bed frame is completely covered by these knots and ropes that are tied around the top of the bed. Is lamali shifas? Why do we need shifshuf? The yard dadah. In other words, it seems that if you would have interpreted mitocho, then that part of the bed frame is exposed. But if you're talking about gaba, then the bed frame is not even exposed. No one sees it. There's no need to beautify it. In other words, we beautify a carpentry because, you know, it has to be aesthetic to the eye. And the question is whether the eye will actually see these aruchos hamita that require shifshuf, that require, you know, smoothing down. Well, that all depends upon whether it's siruga mitocho, siruga melgabo. If it's siruga mitocho, then what you're going to see is the aruchos hamita. That's going to be exposed to the naked eye. But if on the other hand it's algaba, it means that these chavilos and chavolim are covering over the aruchos hamita, meaning the frame of the bed, and therefore there's no need to smoothen out the planks of wood that make up this bed frame. So now the Gemara comes back and interprets the difference between a mita and dargosh without Rabbi Yochanan. Meaning, Rabbi Yochanan said the difference between a mitan and dargosh was whether it's seruga mitocha, seruga melgaba. Now we're going to assume that in all cases, even in the case of the mita, the seruga is mitocha. Hence, we need shifshuf. Elaha v'ha mitocha. Even in the case of a mita, the seruga is mitocha. Right, through these holes that we said we bore holes in the sides of the aruchos hamita, and therefore the aruchos hamita are exposed, and we have to beautify them by doing shifshuf, and that's when it's mekabel tuma. That's the gemara melacha. But what's the difference between the two, between a mita and a dargosh? Mita is aole va'apoke. Okay, I stopped in the middle of a sentence here, but ole and apoki means going in and going out, right? Ayole always means going in, and apoki always means taking out. Now, we're talking about these ropes. Bibizione. Bizione are these very, very large holes in the frame of the bed. And Dargos is Aole Vapote Biavaxa, Vavakosa. We don't use Bizione, which are these holes that we said that you have to bore into the sides of the bed frame, but rather you need Avaxa, Avakosa. That's how he vocalizes, Avakosa. And he says the following, that when you put the straps that are connected to the end of this piece of R, right, the hide that we said that he sleeps upon, when you and they're attached with these straps to the frame of the bed, they go in and out with avkosa. Well, what's this avkosa? He says avkosa is lulos hatluyim b'mikvei haruchos. So in other words, it's not that you put the, you know, you put them directly, you put the R and the, I should say the ritzuos, that the straps at the four corners of the R, you don't put them directly into the, again, we're holding now that everything's mitocho, directly into these holes, but rather, what you put into these holes are rings, so there are rings attached to the holes. So the ritzuos, these straps, they don't go directly, in the case of a dargish, they don't go directly into the bed frame, but rather these straps are attached to the rings, which are called lulos, and that's where the straps will go in and out of these rings. So what do we gain from this? Let's just see. First of all, what we gain is that we definitely need shifshuf. Why? Because it's not since we're going through these holes on the sides of the bed frame, the top of the bed frame is certainly exposed and it requires shifshuf. It has to be smoothened out for beauty purposes. That's the Gemara Malach as far as Kabbalah's Tumah is concerned. And then at the same time, what we do is we gain here is that we understand what a dargosh is. And we have the machlokas between the Chachomim and Rav Shimon Gamliel about what constitutes the chiyuv ovel in the case of a dargosh, and it means one of two things. Either he stands up the dargosh on its side vertically, or he has to remove these lulos, these rings. These rings will function to attach the R, I should say the ritzuos of the R, the ritzuos that surround all the corners of the R into these rings. The rings are pushed into the holes that are bored into the sides of the wood of the framework. And according to Shem Gamliel, you have to remove these rings, or at least remove the connection between the straps and the rings, such that now the mita will fall to the ground, and that's where he's going to sleep on top of the mita. Om Rav Yaakov, Om Rav Yishu, Melevi, Alokhik, Rav Shem Gamliel. We passing like Rabbi Shuv ben Gamliel that in the case of a dargosh, the ovel will be required to remove the connection between the R and these rings, and at that point the R falls down to the ground. And again, we have machlokas whether Rabbi Shuv ben Gamliel is a chumra or a kula. We assume like the Ramban is a chumra, but whereas according to the Ritva, it's dafka kula, that you don't have to do zakifa. One last halach with regard to kfiya samita. Omer Rav Yaakov bar Ami, mita shenakliteha yotzim zokfa. Now what's nakliteha? He says that there are two pieces of wood on both sides, each one respectively on a different side, and they put on top of that of these wood a tent, which is called in Hebrew a kila. What's it called in modern
canopy?
A canopy, excellent, a canopy. Reuven, does he say canopy here in English? Because here in the Hebrew uses the word kila, which I think is a canopy. Okay, Nachlitin, he says, and shnei mutos, eights, gvoim, they're two poles, they're very tall, and they go up to the top, and they were set up on the two ends of the bed, and the point at which these two poles crossed was parallel to the middle of the width of the bed. And then he says that there was an indentation where they would put a kila on top of these two poles, and the kila would sort of, like a tent, it would lay flat, it would sort of fall over the over these two poles, saviv lemita, around the bed, and that would make it into an oel. This is all Rashi, Dibur Asal Naklitel. Now these mitos that have these poles coming out of them were Chubru l'miskeres hamita. They were attached to the frame of the bed, the otzuven, and that's where they came out of. And then, in such a case, if let's say the ovel usually, during, you know, before he became an ovel, he would sleep in such a canopied bed, then during his avelus, he cannot turn the bed upside down, obviously, because it's got a right, some sort of a point on the top. You know, it goes like a triangle on the top of the triangle. So you can't turn it upside down and have it spinning on its on the spitz of the canopy, but rather Zokfra, he somehow is able to tilt it in a way that it stands upwards in a vertical direction, vidayo, and that's enough. See, this Gemara would sort of support the Ramban's opinion. The word vidayo means that, you know, we're going to be lenient here, and all we require is the kifa. Mish, can I see the picture now and see if it helps me at all? All right. So what do we have here?
This one has the whole.
This is mitoko, right?
That's one that's wrapped around the right.
So somehow, if it's wrapped
this
around,
is the sandpaper fish.
Yeah. Okay. So if it's wrapped around, again, I don't know from the picture; it's hard to tell. But the this part of the bed, which is called the aruchos hamita, is exposed, and therefore it needs some sort of process of beautification, of beautifying it. And that's called the Gemara Malacha Shifshu, and they use the R of the Dag. Oh, he has a picture of the R of Dag, you told me?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see. What.
The
does he tell you which fish it is? Yeah. Oh, he tells yeah. exactly which fish it is. All right, for those of you who are fish experts, I have a feeling this might be a tray for fish. I don't know. Anyway,
it has fins and scales.
Oh, it does have fins? I don't know. What is this thing going around over here? Okay, so it's a trigon. Trigon forkfish. Okay, dag. What is this word? Schus. I guess that's the name of the fish. Mimishpachas hatrinonians. Okay, the trigons. Yeshlo snapir. Chose murchav. Vechein zanav aroch ma'ovd. He doesn't tell you if it's kosher or not. I'm not sure if it's kosher. Okay. It doesn't look like kosher fish to me, but it doesn't matter. I mean, we're only using its oils. The oro shel dag zeh hayu mishtamshin bi'avar, back in the old days, kedei l'shayef bo eitz, fine. And today we use, he says, some sort of glass.
Sandpaper.
Sandpaper. Okay, great. All right. That's the best I can do, Rabosa, without taking a crash course in carpentry. You could probably Google ancient beds or something and see what you come up with. All right, let's start the Mishnah of Melech. What are the authorities of a king? And now we're getting really back to Masechta Sanhedrin. So number one, the Mishnah establishes that the right of the king is motzi l'melchemes rishus. In other words, he can compel the people to go out to a war, and this war is not a Melchemes Mitzvah, but rather Melchemes Rishus. So this is really a very far-reaching power of the monarch, because the people are saying, well, I don't want to put my life into danger and fight this battle. We're not even obligated to win this war or to engage in this military conquest. For example, David HaMelech goes out to battle against to conquer Syria, and the halacha is that Syria is a little bit beyond the borders of the state of Israel. So you didn't. This was a melchemes rishus. In fancy English, they call it a discretionary war. But the Mishnah does seem to qualify and restrict the king's powers in this regard. It says, "Al pi bezdin shel shivim v'yechad." Now, in order to appreciate what those words mean, we go back to the Mishnah at the beginning of Masechta Sanhedrin, and you'll take a look approximately, I would say, maybe 15 lines up from the bottom, or smack in the middle of the broader lines, the wider lines. It says, "Ein motzien lemelchemes harshus ella al pi bezdin shel shivim v'echad." Now, the simple pshat in the Mishnah is that there's no melchemes rishus without the approval of the High Court of Israel, which grants the High Court of Israel veto power to decide that they don't want to go out to this battle. Now, there are other requirements which aren't mentioned in that Mishnah. For example, the Urim V'Tumim. They had to first ask the Urim V'Tumim whether or not it was worthwhile engaging in this battle to conquer lands outside the boundaries, beyond the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. But our Mishnah at the beginning of Masechta Sanhedrin is not focused on Melchemes Rishus. That's not the topic of our Mishnah. It's rather the authority of Bezna Gadol, of the 71 judges on the High Court. And they have this authority to, shall we say, nix or veto the Yitzhiel and Melchemes Rishus.
So, a majority of them?
By a majority vote. And that would seem to indicate that the king is not a Groyser Knapper over here. You know what I mean? With all due respect, he's got to get the approval of 71 judges, or at least the majority of them. And on his own, although he decided that, you know, it's time to go out and battle, maybe they, you know, they needed more land, or maybe they needed more money, and they would take the booty and divide it up amongst the poor people. We once had a discussion about that with regard to David HaMelech. But it doesn't go that smoothly. You know, the king's cabinet can make that decision, but he needs the approval of the house or of the senate. I don't know what you want to call the high court of Israel, the judiciary, the supreme court,
the house of lords.
Now, it's very fascinating here, because Rashi elsewhere, not here in Masechta Sanhedrin, has a whole different interpretation of these words, "Al pi bezdin shel shivim v'yechad." And Rashi tells us that the reason why we need "Al pi bezdin shel shivim v'yechad" is kedeshi is palalu, because these were the holiest people, the pious great giants of the generation, and we desperately needed their prayers for in order to guarantee that we would, you know, invoke divine compassion so that we would be victorious in this discretionary war. The Ran goes even a step further. The Ran says that we don't even need the approval of the Bez Nagol. All we need is the decision of the king. And that's why it says the word in our Mishnah is motzi. The word motzi means against the will of the people. So you take the Ran's approach, I mean, this is really almost the exact opposite of what the impression we got from our Mishnah. But so let's go through minimum and maximum. The minimum interpretation of Motzi Limelchemes Rishus is that the king is going to take the initiative. Meaning, it's not that Beis Nagadol, all of a sudden, you know, the 71 judges, they initiated, or they decide, hey, maybe we should go out and conquer the land north of the border of Israel. No. That's nothing. That's not their business. Who's going to initiate the Milchemes Rishus? Motzi. Motzi means the king takes the people out. However, the king, according to this interpretation, has no right to do so without gaining the approval of the Beis Nishal Shim V'yechud. So the basic decision, the initiative, is that of the king, and he needs approval. That's Hakof Alef. The other interpretation is that Al Pi Bezdin Shel Shem V'Echad means unless he gets the approval of the Shem V'Echad, he's not going to have that Siyata D'Shmaya, that divine protection that would guarantee his victorious success in this battle, because he needs the Shem V'Echad to be behind him so that they would pray on his behalf. And finally, we have the Ran, who says explicitly that even if the Bezdin HaGadol would veto this initiative, nevertheless, the king on his own right has the decision-making power and the authority to take the people against their will out to battle. What's common to all interpretations is A, that the king is the one who takes the initiative, and that B, if his initiative is approved, I'm going with the minimalist interpretation, then the people have no choice in the matter. They cannot object. There's no room for demonstrations here and for democracy. Well, we don't want to go out and put our lives on the line for a Melchemes Rishus. No. The king has made that decision. Lomas Hagen, let's assume that he got the approval of the Bezdin Shel Shem V'Echad, and that's it. And again, conditions that have to be met. Maybe you need a Navi, maybe you need a Vitumim. That's not discussed here in Masechta Sanhedrin. That's a sugya in Sota. Here, we're focused exclusively on the issue of Melech and Bezdin HaGadol. What other authorities are granted or powers to the king? Poreitz lasos lo derech v'ein memacha biyodo. Let's say, for example, you own a field or a vineyard, whatever it might be, and the king needs to stretch extend the derech, which is the road, and the road has to cut through your field. He can do so without your permission. No one could protest against the king. He has absolute authority. What's this called in
eminent domain?
Eminent domain, excellent. I was going to say habeas corpus. Eminent domain. He has eminent domain. Okay.
But in eminent domain, the government still has to pay for it. They can take it, but they have to.
Right. I don't know that anybody could demand any money for this. Let's just see. He says here, Hakavani sheyochol hu gam lechayvam. Oh, yeah. Interesting. It seems that some of the commentaries understand that ultimately what the king has the right to do is to force the sale.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Right, that they will be reimbursed for the value of the karka.
Yeah,
but they can't object to the sale itself.
Right, that goes back to British law.
Okay, this is, by the way, a little bit before British law, but just to get to history. Okay, next. What other powers lie in the king, are vested in the king? Now, let's just add one comment here to the derech, this road that he's paving, is derech hamelech ein lo shir. He can decide how wide, there are no limitations as to, it's got to be no more than, let's say, 16 amos wide. He can make it as wide as he wants, and that's the decision of the melech. You begin to understand why Shmuel, and that's going to be our sugya, not for today, maybe for tomorrow, why Shmuel was trying to tell the people when they came to ask for a king that it might not be such a good idea. If the king could conscript their children into an army and force their children to fight a discretionary war, if the king can basically force them to give up their property for the sake of a derech, I mean, you look at what you're getting into. And there are other authorities of the king. So Shmuel was well advised to dissuade the people of that. They shouldn't be so excited. The people said, well, let's be like all the goyim. All the goyim have kings. We want to have a king. And Shmuel warned them that it's not so simple. You have to realize and be aware of what you're getting into, what powers you're investing in the king. And finally, the Mishnah says, "V'chol ha'am bozes him v'nosnim lo v'notel chelik barosh," which means the following: that as a result of the battle, and this is a discretionary war, they take biza, they take the booty, they take possessions. However, on the first round, immediately after they take these possessions, the possessions now are transferred over to the treasury of the king, and he decides what he wants to take from this treasury. He basically takes, Rashi points out, 50%, but it's chelik barosh. It's the, he gets the best of the best. So let's say they took over land, you know, real estate, they took over gold, silver, whatever it might be, and the king gets to shave off half, 50% of the booty for the treasury of the Malchus, and what and it'll take the best of the best. And what's left is the 50% of what we call the Chelek HaRashibo, not the Chelek HaRosh. Rosh means Yofer. And they'll get to divvy up the other 50%. In any event, the Mishnah mentions that in order to go out to battle in a discretionary war, it's got to be Al Pi Bezdin Shel Shivim V'Echad, which is a repeat of what we saw in the first Mishnah of the Masechta. So the Gemara immediately asks, Tanina Chada Zimna. Why does the Mishnah feel compelled to repeat what we've already learned in the first Mishnah? It says, quote, Ein Motzil Melchemes Rishus El Al Pi Bezdin Shel Shivim V'Echad. So the Rishonim are very bothered by this question, because what do you mean it's a repeat? It's not a repeat. The first Mishnah doesn't even mention a word about the Melech. It only mentions the approval and the condition of Bezdin Shel Shivim V'Echad. But what about the, you know, the initiation, you know, initiating this war? That's totally in the shall we say in the authority, within the authority of the king, and that's indicated by Avmish that says Motzi Limel Chemes Harishus. So why does the Gemara feel that Tanina Chada Zimna, we learned it once before, and then we go on to quote the Mishnah at the beginning of the Masechta, it's not really a repeat of what we had before? So I don't know exactly what the answer to that question is. Maybe we'll have an answer as we go along, but right now the Gemara's kasha is that there's no chidush in our Mishnah. And to such an extent that the Gemara has to pull off what we call an Aidi Ditoni Tonanami, which means that we really don't have any chidush in our Mishnah here in the second parak of Sanhedrin. It's a repeat, but Aidi Ditoni Kolmili Demel, since the subject of our Mishnah is what are the authorities and the powers in the king, of the king, is Tonanami, that we also mentioned Motzi'in L'Molchemes Roshus, which means that together with the approval of the High Court of Israel, he can compel the people to go out to fight this battle, and they have no right to object. And that's indicated here in our Mishnah on you know, by the by, meaning as Agavurcha, once we're mentioning the you know, the ability of what do we call it, habeas corpus, whatever the ability, eminent domain. I mean, make the same mistake, sorry, of eminent domain, and other powers of the king that will be listed here in the Mishnah. So therefore he mentions also that the king, together with the approval of the Beis Nagol, will go out to battle. Now, I'm just going to say a few words of introduction to our discussion for tomorrow. As I mentioned earlier, Shmuel, the Navi, is going to warn the people when they come to request the king that they should be aware and beware of the powers of the king. They, you know, you should know what you're getting into. And the Gemara is going to discuss what Shmuel's agenda was. There are two ways of understanding Shmuel. One way is that Shmuel is actually, like the Shulchan Aruch, he's writing the text of the Jewish law book as far as the authorities of the king. The other way of understanding Shmuel is that, no, Shmuel is not talking about the halachic, or shall we say, legal rights of the king within the halacha, but rather Shmuel is only warning them, be careful, because once you agree to appoint a king, the king may take advantage of his position, and he'll push the agenda so far that you'll end up with your children being conscripted into the army, and your plantations will be confiscated, etc., etc. So again, this is going to be the sugya that we want to do tomorrow. The entire parasha of Melech, which Shmuel goes into great detail, tomorrow we'll go through all the details of the parasha, is it Melech Mutarbo? It means that a king is allowed to exercise any of those rights, any of those authorities as Shmuel delineates them, and that's halachically, you know, licensed by the Torah. Or, no, it's only Li'ayim Aleihem, that Shmuel is only coming to warn them, but that's not really what the king halachically is allowed to do. but they have to be aware of the fact and beware of the fact that once the king is appointed, he may, in a sense, take advantage of the people, use his position beyond the what the halacha would advocate and recommend. Alright then, so that's going to be Amritz Hashem, the Neder, and discussion for tomorrow.